Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan along with Will Lynn, and we continue our Myth of Sophia series, and we're exploring the depths of myth and wisdom here on the program. And today, I have to say, Will, like every other segment of the series that we have done, I am very excited about this, whether it was Star Trek and the Borg, whether it was baseball and sports. This is really exciting for me because I started my search in India, so to speak, not physically, but through the writings of a gentleman who is actually going to have a movie come out about him, Awake, the Life of Yogananda, and the autobiography of a yogi, as I've mentioned many times on the program. So we're going back to India on this edition, the 10th edition of Myth of Sophia, exploring the depths of myth and wisdom. And welcome again to the program. And also, let's welcome our guest and have you share with us who we are going to be talking with all the way from India.
So Madhavi Narsale is a professor of Sanskrit and comparative mythology in the Sanskrit department at the University of Mumbai, one of the oldest and most prestigious schools in India. She specializes in the Vedas and Vedanta and is an expert in the fields of Indian mythology and aesthetics. This past April, she curated and led the first annual festival on comparative mythology in India, and she is working with one of her students, Dr. Sunil Parab, to establish a Joseph Campbell Foundation Mythological Roundtable in Mumbai. In addition to her numerous academic contributions, articles, field research, presentations, and her forthcoming book on Vedic sacrifice, Madhavi has also supported the transmission of myth from academia to entertainment. In 2012, she was featured on the Discovery Kids show Mystery Hunters, and in 2009, she participated as a religious expert on a popular game show. Most recently, she consulted for India's wildly popular series, Mahabharat, based on the renowned Indian epic. Welcome, Madhavi.
Hi, namaste.
Namaste.
Namaste. It's wonderful to have you on the program today, all the way from India, and it's 12 hours and a half, a difference between you and I and the three of us, and it's extraordinary in the day in which we live we're able to do this, and there's virtually, I think this is wonderful, there's virtually no latency here. I mean, this is real time. Yeah. We're not using satellite and so forth. Let's talk a little bit about where we're going to go with this, because I know that there are many different sources for the different types, if you will, or aspects of Indian mythology, and I'm wondering if they're specifically rooted in a specific religion, or maybe that's the wrong word to use, philosophy, or specific writings. I know that people are familiar with the Vedas, the Bhagavad Gita, the Mahabharata, and on. I mean, the list just is endless. So maybe that's one of the places we might want to start is in terms of your studies of Indian mythology.
And I think it also sets up the same supporting question, which is you teach in a Sanskrit department, you're a Sanskrit expert, and you're teaching comparative mythology. So so you're working with the sources directly in your study of myth. So so please, talk to us about that.
My journey of understanding mythology in the comparative sense started way back in 1993, where I came across this course on comparative mythology in the Department of Sanskrit, University of Mumbai. Now, there my teachers introduced me to a number of, we are well versed with the texts, but we need to have that much exposure of comparing things with different cultures. And the beauty of this study was that there's a very beautiful saying in Sanskrit which says that Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, the whole world is one family. So just like where we have the story of King Manu with a boat. In biblical mythology, you have Noah and his ark. In Sumerian, you have Gilgamesh. So actually, this is a beautiful world where there are stories which bring people together. And this is how our journey started. And when we have access to the texts, we need to interpret the text with the help of different theories. So this was what my teachers helped us in doing. And this is something which is totally unique and different of this course. As far as Indian sources are concerned, the question which you had asked me, see, we can't say that it is just Hindu mythology. You have Jain mythology, you have Buddhist mythology, you have biblical mythology also. And the fascinating thing of Indian mythology is that new mythologies are keeping on being created. New gods are still being developed. And as they are developed, the stories of these gods are experienced by people and are taken as their guiding light. So this is that mythology which is a living tradition, and that is the beauty of Indian mythology. Lastly, you had asked me about the sources. Yes, we study the Sanskrit sources, which are the Vedas, then the Mahabharata, the Bhagavad Gita. At the same time, there are the Puranas, the 18 Puranas which have been written by Vyas, and more than that, there are many local Puranas also, which is the work which I do, which I try to investigate them and try to find them that what do they want to say and what do they want to convey it to us. Apart from that, there's a lot of work which is going on regarding folk literature, then tribal mythology. So these are the other sources also which are being explored and which are being tapped, and also an attempt is going to document these sources.
Two sidebars. Number one, from my study and research, the various texts that you referenced and then others as well, specifically in Sanskrit, the books, the physical books, have not been... and I mean no disrespect to anyone else, but they have not been deified by those who read them and or follow the philosophies, unlike other religions have sort of deified the book, that it's more important than anything else. And yet it's the stories within the text that are what are important.
Yeah. Yes. See, but you can say that see Bhagavad Gita as a book is regarded as the last word for Indian for understanding the Indian philosophy.
Is it considered inspired writing?
Sorry, I didn't get you.
I say, is it considered to be sort of inspired writing? These are the words of God, kind of thing.
People consider them as the words of the God. Suppose if we try to say that, well, these are the shlokas which have been developed over the years, the mind of the people is that as these are the words of Krishna, we are taking it as it is because it helps us in understanding our life. It develops a positive attitude in our life, and it helps us to overcome our problems. So that is the approach.
Well, so it's so warming actually to hear you talk about mythology in ways that are actually very familiar and consistent with some of the ways that we study myth at Pacifica, and also some of the ways it's talked about in the Joseph Campbell Foundation. And you mentioned a number. I'm actually very curious how similar our approaches to the study of myth are, and where there might be differences. You already in talking about the sources, it's obvious that you're very close with the linguistics, with the language itself, and that you've spent some time doing field research, which brings in the archaeological element. In our program, we give emphasis to comparative mythology. Linguistics and archaeology come in. It's hard for us to spend a lot of time doing that in Santa Barbara, but at the same time, They're crucial for us. And the other thing that we do a little bit of at Pacifica is psychology. We look at the stories from a psychological point of view. And one of the things that allows is that in the United States, these traditions, the myths that we're looking at, are not as the culture is not as religiously connected to some of these stories as has happened, you know, in India. For there hasn't been a separation from these epics and from the Vedas for so long. so we don't have the same kind of investment in a lot of the myths and stories, which sets us up to get a lot of value from looking at them from a more psychological point of view. And I'm curious if that's on the radar, if that's an approach that you take as well, and how you juggle that with the clear religious qualities of the myths.
Religious?
Yeah. The way the myths build into really a religious community. And how you?
Because they are regarded as when we say sometimes it so happens that when we use the word myth for some kind of a story, there is a kind of an objection saying that, well, this is not, when you say myth, it means it is untruth.
Right.
And so say that this is history because this is what our texts have said. And so suppose if you say that it is so Ram was a mythological hero, it is that no, he's not a mythological hero, he is a historical figure. So this is the approach, because people over here, they feel that they are the part and parcel of their life, and they are their guiding light. And I'll tell you that many people try to follow certain sects, certain religious groups, and these religious groups they derive their philosophy from the heroes which are there. They derive that some groups derive their philosophy from the Ramayana, some groups derive their philosophy from some Puranas, and then these groups have an influence over people, and therefore, so whatever is preached by them, that becomes the truth. And therefore, it is a part and parcel of behavior, of their day-to-day life, of their preferences, of their priorities. And this is how it is well embedded in their psyche. So one experiment I would like to share with you was that regarding different feminine figures, sometimes you may be saying that so-and-so person is a Hera kind of a personality.
All right.
Or Aphrodite kind of a personality. So it is said that a mother, a doting mother, looking after her children in India, can be called as a Parvati kind of a personality. So such type of concepts are being developed to understand the Indian mind, the Indian psyche. So this is the work which is being done.
Let me ask the second part of my sidebar, having to do specifically with Sanskrit, and what you're describing as far as the Indian philosophy and the Indian mythology seems to be mirrored in the United States, specifically when it comes to specifically Christianity and all of its different sects, and that they hold the writings to be sacred. These are the words of God. These are true stories. We've only been here 6,000 years, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm wondering if there is the same challenge, I'll put it that way, when it comes to translating from Sanskrit into the other languages that these books have been translated into, specifically English, because that's what I read, is there much lost in translation in terms of meaning and intent and vibration, if you will, from the, let's say, the Bhagavad Gita in Sanskrit versus the Bhagavad Gita in English or French or German, etc.?
There are certain concepts which we feel that cannot be exactly represented through other languages. For example, the very concept of moksha or the five elements, that is, which is understood as the air, the sky, etc. One question which was raised by one scholar was that the word sky cannot be regarded to be similar to that of Akash, because the concept of Akash is something which is a complete void. So much gets actually lost when you, or another question, another thing which I'd like to tell you is that the very word sacrifice is sometimes when we use the word yagya, And if we translate it with the word sacrifice, it is regarded as an objection, because the concept which is there behind sacrifice is regarded to be different than that of yagya in Indian tradition. So there is a trend which goes on, which goes and says that when there are certain key terms in Sanskrit or in any Indian vernacular, maintain those key terms as they are.
Mm. And I
instead
think
of translating them totally into English.
And I think that's mostly how it was taught to me by my professor of Hinduism or Hindu mythology and Indian mythology. Is, you know, we continue to use the words like samsara and moksha as opposed to try and translate them. And I think that I can, to me, it's actually, I would actually see, you know, I'm a scholar, but I think beyond scholars, I think words like moksha and nirvana are
nirvana,
they're practically
because,
English words. They've been so adopted by now. Of course, they're not English words, but there's not a word for them, and they've been adopted for what they offer.
And even the phrase namaste.
Mm-hmm,
I mean, everybody is using the phrase. And to just dovetail one more thing off of that, in some of my other research, I have found that, whether this be true or not, maybe you can elaborate on this. I don't know if this is in your area of expertise in regards to Sanskrit, but I'm aware of specifically a school in London where they are actually teaching children Sanskrit.
Yes.
And the studies are showing the impact that very study is having on the development of their brains in a very positive way. Can you elaborate at all on that?
First of all, there is a belief, a theory. I won't say belief as such, but it is regarded that the vibrations, which are the sound vibrations, which are created by uttering certain mantras, because it is said that you use all the parts of your mouth for uttering words which are there in Sanskrit. So these create a positive vibrations on your mind, and these vibrations, they have an impact on your studies. Secondly, if you think of Sanskrit as a language, it is a highly systematic language, and every Sanskrit word has got a case ending, and because of that case ending, it becomes complete in its sense. It does not have an expectancy of some other word at that time to convey the meaning. For example, when I say that the hunter kills the tiger, so the hunter is the subject and the tiger is the object. Mm-hmm. But you can shift, if you shift the word tiger in the place of hunter, the meaning changes in English. Unlike in Sanskrit, the meaning does not change even if you change the position of the words. So it is because a word becomes a complete meaningful unit. This is the reason that the mind starts getting trained to think in a particular framework. And in that framework, there is a kind of a discipline. And when this discipline is embedded in your day-to-day life, it creates a very different and a very positive and a beautiful impact. That is the reason why these results have shown such a kind of great change in the studies or in the behavioral pattern of those children. Because I have been seeing those videos and those interviews which are there on the YouTube about children chanting mantras in Sanskrit, and why do they like that language, etc., etc.
I have to look that up.
That's fascinating. It makes me think a little bit about this phenomenon called basically the phenomenon is going to jump in my head in a minute. It's the phenomenon is if you play music or sounds and you put sand over a piece of paper or over the speaker, different notes will create completely unique geometric patterns. And geometric patterns, elaborate patterns. So the sand, what this shows is the way that the vibrations can translate into, you know, the particles of our being, how the vibrations of the music, of the sound, you know, or even of a word can actually manifest in the and is an influence on our material bodies.
And sound is something which is regarded to be beyond matter. Mm-hmm. And the journey of the sound is endless. And it is regarded to be the subtlest manifestation of the five elements. Mm-hmm. And when you try to utter a mantra, it is you're trying to gain control over that subtlest aspect of the element of the elements. That is the idea which goes behind this, the power of the mantras.
It's so similar to the notions of Egyptian, I shouldn't call it magic, but you know, the Egyptian idea that basically the Book of Knowledge was a book of words. It's just a book of the classification, and so the name of to know the name of a thing was to have power over it, which is why Isis gets power over Ra by learning his true secret name.
So are you saying that I'm not that familiar with Sanskrit, so I don't know how many letters are in that alphabet and on, but what I do know of, for example, another language, which is the Hebrew language, the Aleph Bet, and each letter in the 22 characters has its own legend, its own color, its own vibration, its own tone, and so on and so forth. It sort of has its own story. So now you start putting those letters together into words, and words into sentences, and sentences.
Have such kind of similar things.
It does. Okay. Interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
Now, how old is Sanskrit, by the way? What is the best estimation?
Now, that is a pretty controversial question.
Uh-oh.
Because, there are two opinions as such. There is one opinion which says that Sanskrit is as old as the Indus, or even before that, because there is a theory which says that the Indus civilization and the Vedic civilization are one and the same. So it dates behind 3000 BC. And there is one standard philological theory which says that the composition of the Vedas is near about 2000 BC onwards. And then from Vedic literature, you have Sanskrit being evolved as a classical language. And it was the work of Panini, the great Sanskrit grammarian, who set a certain form of rules. Say and these rules bound that language in such a manner that from say 500 BC till today, the language has not changed.
And how
it
much
has
did
remained
the epics,
as it is?
How much do you think the myths and epics had to do with the consistency of the language over time?
When I read the epics, I found that the language goes very close to that of the rules of Panini. So the rules which were laid down by this great grammarian were followed even in the narrative flow, because sometimes in the narrative flow you are bound to commit mistakes. You are bound to use a different of words, but these words are not used in the epics. They stick to the rules of this great grammarian. That is something which amazed me a lot.
Well, I found that, for example, in Spain, it was the systematization of the Spanish language was crucial to the creation of a sense of a Spanish nation when they were trying to rally against the Moors who had invaded Spain. And so the language and then the stories which worked with this newly official language are what helped to perpetuate the Spanish language as a systematized language into the culture at large. And what I'm curious about is how much the myths, the epics, how much they may not have just conformed to the language structures, but how much they actually may have helped to solidify the language in the culture.
Now, when the language is unchanged, it becomes easy for generations after generations to not meddle in with the interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
So you won't get a completely different interpretation of a particular. See, the context can change.
Mm-hmm.
An interpretation of a myth may change as per the context, but the linguistic interpretation does not change, because the language has survived in the same way. The survival of the language is very static.
So that's fascinating. That's what I was wondering. And
yeah.
So there's actually something I want to bring up that wasn't in our notes, but it's something that really I'm very curious about. And So this tradition of studying Sanskrit and also, you know, a more general study of Indo-European languages has been applied to the field of comparative mythology by yes. scholars like Jan Puvel and Scott Littleton. And also Maria Gimbutas, and who presented this Kurgan theory, and I'm curious how far you I know you're focused on Sanskrit, but I'm also curious how much you've studied or how interested you are in the Indo-European language group to which it's it is the primary family member that we study now, I'll stop with that question.
As such, we discuss about the Indo-European family when mm-hmm. we discuss about the origin of Sanskrit language. Mm-hmm. And also we try to compare the Latin, the Romanian words, and also there is one more language which you may be aware of is the Avesta language, which mm-hmm. is of the language of a Zoroastrian community in India. This community comes from Iran. It has migrated Persians. And settled down. Mm. The language of Avesta, the language of Vedic literature, is very much similar to each other. And it is also one among the Indo-European families. Mm-hmm. So while discussing all these kinds of issues, we discuss about the Indo-European families, but we don't delve much into the theory part of it.
Mm-hmm. The main reason, real quick, and then we should move past Sanskrit, but the real reason I ask is because I think it really sets up an understanding of why you're teaching comparative mythology in a Sanskrit department. Because if you look at the Indo, that's been such a strong, you know, focus on comparative mythology or the languages, and we can see, you know, it's not just that Indra is similar to Zeus and that they, you know, wield lightning and are on top of mountains and are chieftain gods. Mm. There's a linguistic relationship.
Linguistic, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, I'm curious, one final question for me regarding Sanskrit, and then we're going to kind of move on to I'm going to call this the myth of the myths, mm-hmm. and that is the multiple gods of Indian mythology. I've learned that there are no multiple gods. They are no different than all of the various names of God in the Old Testament and the New Testament. They're just different, if you will, variations on a theme, if you will, aspects of God. But how influential, if at all, is the Sanskrit language on the creation of these myths, knowing what we now know, as you've shared with us, the power that the Sanskrit language has on the brain and in our thought processes, in our critical thinking, et cetera, et cetera?
First of all, the Sanskrit language serves as the primary source. So if you have to trace an antiquity of a particular deity, of a particular god, you have to go back to the Sanskrit text. You have to visit the text. You have to revisit, read and reread. And then you can understand or then you can derive some kind of a meaning from those texts. Mm-hmm. Say, for example, you have Indra as the deity. Now, Indra is the deity. If you can trace the origin of that deity, of course, it is regarded as a manifestation of nature. But in due course of time, it has changed, and that Indra became the king of gods. But later on, that god had declined, and Krishna came up. Now, so when you have to trace the journey of Krishna back to the roots, you have to understand the Sanskrit sources which are there. So without that, you can't proceed with regards to Indian mythology.
Hmm. Very interesting. I find this conversation is just so intriguing to me. I mean, then there's never going to be enough time to really delve into all the different areas that I'm thinking about. And of course, my main interest obviously derives from, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, from my what I consider my metaphysical primer, which is Autobiography of a Yogi, which is where I really learned about Indian culture more than from any other source. And then I began to read other works and tried to delve into Bhagavad Gita, but it was as insurmountable as
War and Peace. Take some help to get through that sometimes.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm waiting for the movie. I'm sure there's probably got to be a movie of some of the Vedas from the Gitas.
Sets us up.
Yeah.
Where I wanted to go.
Just to add up,
please.
Some say 10, 15 years back, there was a Sanskrit movie on the Bhagavad Gita, and where the five Pandavas, who played a key role in the Mahabharata epic, the five Pandavas are regarded as the five organs of sensory perception. This is the symbolic interpretation, and Krishna and Draupadi is so she is the wife of these five Pandavas, so she is their mind, and
like
the intellect is Krishna. So this is how the entire movie actually moved around. So that was very exciting and a different kind of an interpretation, and that too, an abstract interpretation in a movie. That was something very unique.
Well, as interesting as the Bhagavad Gita is to read, as little as happens as far as action wise in the story, I'd imagine that for a movie or a film, that adding some twist and interpretation like that made it much more visually entertaining.
I'll have to look that up too.
Well, so this actually sets up. I wanted to ask Madhavi, you were a researcher on the Mahabharata TV series for Star Plus Network, and this is if I understand right, the largest national network in India.
Yes,
and the show was, I mean, there are over 250 episodes, and it was an absolutely enormous and wildly popular. And this there have been a number of shows based on and movies based on the Ramayana and Mahabharata, and I was wondering if you could tell a little bit about one, what it was like for you to participate as a mythologist, you know, bringing what you've learned into entertainment, and then I'll ask you also maybe a little bit about what the world of Indian mythology in the realm of entertainment is like in India.
When I was associated with the Mahabharata, actually there are two serials. One serial was nearly in 1990s, and the Mahabharata, which was a montage. So what the epic said, it was similarly depicted. Now the task in 2013 was to try to tap the silenced voices which are there in the epic. So there are lots. For example, there is one character called Gandhari, and she was married to a king who was blind. And when she comes to know that she is getting married to a blind man, the epic says that she blindfolded herself. Now, there is a lot of silence over here. So what rumbles would go in the mind of a girl, say, of 19 or 20 years of age, or would it be a kind of a political compulsion to get married to such a kind of a man? So all these questions were there, and we were trying to answer such kind of questions in our epic, which is a very different thing which we did. Another thing which I'd like to tell you is that one of the main characters of the epic, Draupadi, she emerged from the fire. She emerged as a girl of 16, directly from the fire. That is what is said in the epic. So the question which was asked by the writer was that, what would be a psychology of a girl who has not seen her childhood? So the childhood span,
like Eve,
the span of 16 years is completely silenced by the myth that Draupadi emerged from the fire. So, and is it that reason which made her a hard-hearted woman to to be the cause of this Mahabharata war was the question which we were trying to tackle, and that was what we tried to analyze in our story.
What a fantasy to get to work with mythology and actually not just to try and do justice to it, what's written on the page, but to even be asked and encouraged to take it further. Yeah. What a dream. Yeah. I wish we get to do that stuff with our myths here. But the viewers, there must be, because you got to do that because there, as you mentioned, there was a Mahabharata before that focused. Yeah. So by now you're in several rounds and the audience is so familiar with the story. That's what I want to ask you. What is the familiarity level with these epics and with Indian mythology, and how much of it comes from the entertainment?
Entertainment plays a very important role. For example, the earlier Mahabharata was seen by so many people that there are newspaper cuttings which would say that roads would be deserted. And at that time in 1990s, television reached different households only because of such kind of mythological serials like the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. So the entire nation could get connected to one single story. So right from Kashmir to Kanyakumari, so from the north to the south, from the east to the west, this was a common thing which was observed, was that people during that particular time slot would get engaged in that serial, and maybe that would be, this would be because of the religious sensibilities in 1990s. But in 2013, where we have a generation which is tech savvy, which is digital, and which does not know much about Indian culture, how to catch them in front of that television for half an hour was a challenge. So of course we tried to show a different kind of a story. That was one thing. At the same time, we tried to see that the characters look, in the words of the young generation, cool and handsome.
Okay, so one of your students.
And one more thing was that there was an analysis of that story in 3 minutes by Krishna. So Krishna would be the director in that entire serial. So where he would give his own take, his own opinion. Say, for example, the negative character. What would be the cause of such a kind of a negative character? Is it wrong parenting? Is it wrong training? Is it wrong education? Is it greed, or is it insecurity, or is it lack of expertise? So Krishna would give his own opinion over that, and that was something that those 3 minutes were liked by the young generation.
Fascinating.
You know, this sounds an awful lot like what we talked about in one of our previous series. A good friend of mine back in Phoenix, where I'm from, Phoenix, Arizona, we were big Star Trek fans. And at that time in the 90s, late 80s and early 90s, of course, it was the Next Generation series that was on television. And he and I used to just talk about these episodes all the time and the profound messages. And he says, you know, that series is our modern day mythology. So I started to watch the shows from that perspective. So what you're telling me is these television shows that were being shown in India in the 90s, around that same time, were not just your modern day. They were your ancient mythology too. They were put into modern context so that people could finally begin to understand them without feeling put upon to have to read through an enormous tome to have some wise man or sage or instructor or somebody to help to explain them.
And not only explain, but connect. See, for example, when he raised the question of wrong parenting, was something which one of my viewer commented on that, and where she said that, well, this is the thing which I have faced in my house, that it is wrong parenting which has led to some kind of family issues. So what Krishna is speaking is what comes in my mind.
Interesting.
Go ahead. So this is the connect which was very, very, very essential, and that clicked. And we had initially the permission of only 128 episodes, and that went to 278
wow.
episodes.
Wow.
That is the change which happened.
Now, are these
with
episodes?
The connection. Wow.
Yeah, are these episodes available online, and are they placed with English subtitles, or do we have English dubbed in, or how is that going to be? Because I'm not going to be able to sit and watch something
yeah.
that's all done in a language that I just
right.
exactly.
am never going to
exactly.
understand.
Yeah, I'll surely discuss this with the producer of English subtitles. Surely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would be
yeah,
great.
But these were dubbed in different vernaculars. So it was not just Hindi, but these were dubbed in Tamil, Telugu.
Wow.
And yeah, so in South Indian languages also.
Let me ask you a question. I don't want to go back too far to the whole subject of Sanskrit, but when you say that when we speak Sanskrit, I guess I'm curious as to how that sounds. Is the word namaste not Sanskrit, or is it written in Sanskrit but we're saying it in another mm-hmm. language? How is that transition made? What is I don't know if I've ever heard somebody speaking if in fact it is the Sanskrit language.
I didn't get your question. So you mean to say that namaste is not sounds? I didn't get your question.
He's trying to ask how different is Sanskrit, for example, from Hindi. If we hear Hindi, is Sanskrit a phonetic language? Is it a how does it sound and live?
It is phonetically very similar.
Okay.
Rather, I would say that the sounds, the vowels, the consonants are derived from Sanskrit. So Hindi is a language which has got a very good connect with Sanskrit.
Mm, okay.
So
and modern Hindi is more Sanskritized.
Okay.
Is the word namaste
yeah.
Sanskrit
huh?
or derived from
yeah,
it?
Yeah, namaste is a Sanskrit word.
Okay.
But it is salutations to you.
Mm-hmm. I
so,
honor the space within
so,
you where God resides
so,
kind of thing.
So here the word you is in the second person
mm-hmm.
grammatically.
Mm-hmm.
And in Hindi or in Sanskrit also, in the second person we have two types of second persons. One is just to call you as a friend, and if you is a respectable personality, and another word is used. So that is the difference which is there. But namaste is very much Sanskrit.
I cannot believe how fast this time is going. We have still
yeah, right.
lots of time left,
yeah.
but. I'd like to, and I know that Will wants to go
yeah.
into some of the characters in the mythological stories of India. As I mentioned earlier, there are, I don't know how many different attributes of God that are listed within the context of Indian mythology. You know, Shakti, Shiva, there's Lakshmi, which is another attribute. I'm trying to remember some of the others off the top of my head. They're escaping me, but nonetheless. And yet there's something, from my perspective, there's something so familiar and even comforting, if you will, in thinking about this particular mythology. I don't know, maybe just from my perspective, there's a connection, maybe having to do with past lives. I have no idea. but can we talk a little bit about that in terms of the deity that we know in the West as God, the creator, and so forth.
Well, before we skip topics, I really want to say a couple things about where we just were, if that's
sure.
okay.
Sure. No, go right ahead.
One is on viewing the content, I'm actually making a page on Mythosophia that is I'm making a series of pages, the first one for Hindu mythology, which is basically a gallery of movies, videos, TV shows that are based on Indian mythology that are free and easy to find on YouTube. Or if they're not free, I just put the trailer of it. So basically, it's an easy source for people that are interested to find the media, the movies, the content. And as far as the Mahabharata that you worked on, I haven't found it in English yet. But the intro, the very, very, very beginning, has been translated into English, which was nice to see. It's Krishna starts. And the other thing I really want to just really quick jump back to is you talked about trying to connect with an audience, and you talked about going a little deeper into the characters. And one of the things that, one of your students, Dr. Sunil, mentioned is that modern stories, retellings of the epics are actually getting darker. Even some of the bad guys are being written as good guys. You know, this is similar to some postmodernism in the United States. Is this a big part of keeping the, modern audience attentive? What's going on, and how is the more conservative audience reacting?
First of all, this type of understanding the different characters in a totally different angle was done in 1970s, where there is one character called Karna in Mahabharata, who was regarded as an anti-hero, was depicted in a very different angle, and that clicked the sensibilities of people in such a manner that people forgot the original Karna, which is there in the Mahabharata, and started regarding this particular text as the source book of Karna as the hero of the epic. That was the change which happened in 90s or in 2000, etc. You will find that there are different characters. Say the Ravan in the Ramayana is regarded as a negative character, but he is portrayed in such a way that what would be the mind which goes on in understanding Ravan. For example, one interesting thing which my grandmother would say was that Ravan was such a great character that to kill him you require a god to incarnate. So Lord Rama is the incarnation of Vishnu. And Ravan is such a great character that to kill him, God had to come down on the earth. Now, this is done by my grandmother, who is who was not that educated. But this is her interpretation. Now, this interpretation is taken up in a systematic manner, and facts are presented in a very in a beautiful story to show how Ravan was correct and how Ram was incorrect. Or how Duryodhan, who is the dark character, is was right in his own way when he demanded the kingdom against the Pandavas. So this is actually liked by the audience because they're getting a totally different perspective, an inverted perspective. And this inverted perspective is liked by them because they also have questions on the epic. They also have their own answers. They have their issues. And it is their mind which is being talked about by such kind of authors. Through works like Ajaya, or through works like Asura. Now these are the books which are written in English, which will get translated in Indian languages. And number of editions are coming up. Not just one edition, but say third edition, fourth edition are coming up of such kind of readings. The author especially says that this is the subaltern reading.
The what
he
reading?
Said that this is, yeah, the, he has used the word that this is the subaltern. So understand. So the author personally said that my effort is to give voice to the subaltern in Indian tradition.
That's so great. And you know, it's I can look at some similar processes, you know, went on in the United States with Christianity, with some of these traditions and not just with Christianity, but with like Batman, you know, where the characters go from very bright characters to let's explore, because one of the main thrusts of this move is to take away this sense that there's an objective good guy and one of the big moves is to respect and appreciate the complications of all the psyches involved, the good and the bad, and to kind of de-simplify these characters.
The reason is that the characters are not portrayed as white or black, but they are gray.
Yeah.
And that's colorful. The gray area. That gray area is becomes very colorful in, in such kind of books or movies or novels.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I mean, if what we're learning now, especially in say psychology or psychiatry, and that is that we all have a dark side that we must learn to embrace, because when we start to separate and we start to compartmentalize, we actually do more harm to ourselves than good.
Yes.
Because it's like saying, I have a left hand, but I don't have a right hand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you would never do that. So we have to acknowledge that there is that dichotomy in a sense. From one level, it's a dichotomy. But on another level, as you were saying, Will, and even you, Doctor, is that it is the total aspect of the light and the dark and the gray that makes us who we are.
Mm-hmm.
To remove all of those parts of our lives that we might look back upon and say regret, saying, boy, I wish I hadn't done that. And if you were to remove those parts from your life's path or what timeline, your present day person would not be the person that he or she is.
Right here.
Yeah right here and now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's something that I think is very intriguing. Now, I'm also curious about these television programs. You say they were widely viewed and accepted and talked about and what have you. What was it about these television programs that intrigued people so? Like for me, and I'm sure Will, Star Trek Next Generation, because I was into science fiction, I liked the messages and so forth, and there was some action, and there was a lot of dialogue too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they all weren't just talky
the
things.
The dialogues are actually in India, the dialogues are in the form of arguments.
So one
person is trying to explain his side, and the other person is trying to counter argue that. So it is as we call in Sanskrit the Purva Paksha and the Siddhanta Paksha, the prima facie and the opponent and the defendant. So such type of dialogues are there, and these dialogues are greatly appreciated by people.
So people were watching because they wanted to see the how the conflict was worked out, how the argument, if you will, using that word, was going to play out.
As Amartya Sen has said that in his book, The Argumentative Indian.
You have to grab the viewer in some fashion, and at least I'm assuming, you know, there was no gunplay or sword fights or bloodletting, what have you. This was more intellectual.
There's that too.
Well, I know that's in the stories.
In the story, the war was, of course, there.
Yeah.
War was a great part of
that
story.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, the verbal war was much appreciated by people than the visual war.
Yeah, it's not like here, whereas there's no way that in the United States, the most popular scene from a war would be the scene where they're not fighting.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, that's something that the people, they want to see. They want to see the train wreck, as it were. Yeah,
but, you know, on that note, as we're talking about, you know, the contemporary exploration of the darker side, it's not that this isn't embedded in the ancient myths either. One of the things about that story is that Vishnu is actually encouraging this war. This war is not something he's not the divine figure trying to avoid war. In fact, he's telling Arjuna, you know, pick up your bow. This is a time we've got to do this. And so there is a sort of amorality even there, or maybe I'm misreading it, but to me it is a certain type of divine amorality even there.
In a way, one kind of interpretation of the Bhagavad Gita was that Bhagavad Gita is that epic which actually encouraged violence. But in what violence in the, if you see the story, in that story, there is violence, there is war. But ultimately, what is the Bhagavad Gita trying to tell? It is actually trying to tell us that there is a lot of violence which is going on in the mind of Arjun.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Arjun, the character in the Bhagavad Gita, and Arjun has to fight with that mental violence.
Mm.
So if you see that the narration of the Bhagavad Gita starts with that conflict which is going on in his mind, and that mental conflict has to be solved. And that was the task which Krishna played as a counselor, is to actually subjugate, is to suppress, is to convince Arjun that go beyond that conflict. Mm-hmm. Try to see yourself as a person who is totally detached. So at times it happens that it may happen with you also, that you may feel, why am I doing all this? When you feel detached from your work, and that detachment actually makes you more and more prone to understanding yourself, to understanding your sense of duty, to understanding the purpose for which you are here on this earth, and to understand much more about you.
It seems to me that the rejuvenator destroyer aspect of the Gita has to do with cleaning the slate, doing away with the old to bring in the new.
Story is actually a transition from, if I understand it right, a kind of older age, an older dynasty that may be related to the original Aryan dynasty, kind of passing to the Pandavas who are more native. And so there's a real passage of power.
So there are a number of interpretations regarding this, the change in the dynasties. So if you see that there are two primary dynasties of the Kshatriyas, the Surya Vamsh and the Soma Vamsh. And if you see the Soma Vamsh dynasty, to which Krishna belonged to, is a more complex dynasty. And so from that solar dynasty, it is movement from the solar to the lunar dynasty. So that is a transition which the epic is trying to show.
That's very interesting. Solar to lunar.
And you can try to interpret that in the psychological angle also. There's a lot of room for interpretation. This is what
thousands of
in
years
my
of
talk
it.
I have realized.
Absolutely. Now, I've heard it. I'm curious. These stories are extremely important. These mythological stories are very important because of the messages that they impart, and that's just one aspect thereof. They can be certainly very entertaining, and of course, they've been turned into something that draws people in. I'm curious about I'll use the term the migration of this Eastern thought to the West, and the way that it has slowly become a part of our Western mindset. Now, I don't know whether it necessarily started exclusively with or predominantly with Paramahansa when he came over here in the early part of the 20th century, or if that process had started much earlier. But I'm curious.
My dad would point to the Beatles.
Well, but that would been
right.
after. But
right.
But nonetheless, there's this trailer for the movie that's coming out that shows Steve Jobs. They talk about Steve Jobs.
Oh, right.
And that there was only one book that he had on his iPod. And that was Paramahansa's book. And I thought, that's very interesting. So I don't want to necessarily focus exclusively on this individual, but I'm curious as to whether he and or others like him, either prior to him or after him, have done more harm than good, or have actually created a very beneficial
propagation.
Propagation's a good word, of this Eastern philosophy, if you will, and helping people to understand that, gee, there's more out there in the world than just what you
Western,
already know.
In India, when we were exposed to the Indian thought moving to the West, it has been projected as spirituality versus materialism. I don't know how true is it, but it is said that Western culture is more materialistic, and if you see the Eastern culture, the Indian culture predominantly is spiritual, and it is spirituality which leads to happiness. So material pleasures give you limited happiness. For example, there is a poster which would say that Bed can give you place to sleep, but it is only peace who can put you to sleep.
Hmm.
So, so food can make you, you can eat that food, but it is only peace which would make you feel happy about what you have got. So, so this is regarded as, so food, bed, money, etc. are all material things, and if and a true yogi, a true aspirant of something which is beyond materialism, is tends to be spiritual, and these material pleasures are of no significance to such a kind of a person, and that actually is something which has attracted the West. This is what has been projected in front of us. I don't know how true it would be, but but while analyzing such a kind of phenomenon, as you say, it is actually, it has brought the world closer. It is how the West would, so West may perceive East in a totally different manner. It may, so sometimes it is said that the perception of India is of the naked sadhus and snake charmers and elephants on the street, but that would be one perception. These yogis and swamis, etc., they have actually changed the perception of the East in the West, which is good actually.
So
I don't think it's a harm.
So what you said about the materialism versus spirituality, you know, obviously it's kind of where in the West we have Mater and Eve, who is clearly the mother figure of matter. In the East or in Indian philosophy and both Buddhism and Hinduism, you have Maya, who is a mother figure, but instead of
Maya,
being associated with instead of Mater being matter mother, Maya is more like the non-material, the illusory, the illusion. But I hate to reduce to the word illusion.
Spiritual matter.
It is regarded as that this is the world which is an illusory world in which you are living, and true knowledge is beyond such kind of illusion. This is one type of philosophy.
So
and at that time when you identify yourself with that God, G capital, then this illusion is perishes, is vanishes, not perishes, it vanishes, and that's the ultimate bliss. So the concept of bliss is oneness with God.
And what's incredible is that that's actually unbelievably consistent with the Pythagorean philosophy and with Platonic philosophy, which were very popular before materialism became so dominant in the West. And as materialism and science became so dominant, then it was very much thanks to Vedic philosophy and metaphysics that the West was able to soften its materialistic shell, because you have Hegel. Hegel is the first kind of Westerner to bring in Hindu metaphysics and his discussion of will to power, and this was hugely influential.
I remember that I introduced Hegel, I introduced Greek philosophy and Hegel and Kant to our students of Vedanta, and there in one of my lectures on Hegel, at that time I could compare the philosophy of logic, Nyaya philosophy, to what Hegel was thinking about, the creation of categories, etc., etc. So it's quite close.
And then the transcendental philosophers of Emerson and Thoreau, hugely, you know, hitting the culture in the late 1800s, early 1900s, well before the Beatles made it wildly popular.
I'd have to say, Doctor, that I cringe every time I hear our government say that we're going to export democracy to other parts of the world, primarily because of what I know of what we've been talking about in this past hour, and thinking, boy, if we're doing that, then we're actually doing the rest of the world a disservice, because they don't need any more materialism in that regard. Because that's really, I mean, they talk about individuality and freedom and liberty and those types of things. But unfortunately, we see where that's gotten us in this country. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, the general concept, if you will. But in terms of how it has played out over the last 200 plus years here, you know, everybody's now worried about their personal privacy and their freedom and their liberty and all of these things.
But these ideas have also invaded the Indian homes.
Yes, I know.
The urban Indian homes where
and I'm real sorry about that.
Privacy. So I remember my good old childhood days where a house of 500 square feet would be sufficient for five people, and now a house of 700 square feet is not sufficient for four people.
Oh, wow.
So these are the changes which are there, of course.
We have to
accept that these are the fruits of globalization.
True.
Right?
I mean,
fruits is a good choice of word.
Part of the evolutionary
symbol.
Yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say it's just part of the evolutionary process, and obviously, when you have these two sides of the scale with, I'll say, high-end spiritualism, if you will, from the East and high-end materialism from the West, and eventually we're going to find an equilibrium. We're
going
to find
a balance. Maybe we have cures for each other.
Maybe that may be true. We may have something. And I think that was one of the things, too, that is spoken about when bringing the Eastern philosophy to the West. It's that even Paramahansa made the comment that, you know, we're going to bring this to the West, and they're going to help us with this other aspect of what we're kind of missing.
Yeah,
in
well,
the East.
They sure have caught on with Western science in India.
Absolutely,
at a rapid pace.
Sadly, we are fast approaching the end of our time together, and I have to say, Doctor, that this has just been an incredible hour, and I want to thank you so much for taking this time.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for joining us.
Same here.
I look forward to sharing this with the mythology students at Pacifica and hopefully the Joseph Campbell Foundation as well.
I have three questions that I usually put to my guests at the end of our time together that I'd like to put to you. And Madhavi Narsale?
Narsale.
I did get it the third time. Madhavi Narsale. Let me ask you, who is Madhavi Narsale?
I have been pondering on this since I saw your write-up.
And, I tipped her off.
I have been pondering as to exactly. So in the words of Shankaracharya, you can say that Chidananda Swarupa Shivoham Shivoham. So I am the Shiva, the ultimate bliss. So in the spiritual sense, but very much there in this world where I'm a mother, I'm a wife, and of course a teacher.
So you're the Buddha pointing up and touching the ground at once.
Something
like that.
I will share with you that my present wife some 10, 12 years ago was asking her mentor for a name. And she waited for weeks and was very impatient. And finally, he actually gave her two names and said, choose. And one of them was Shiva.
Shiva.
And the other, I beg your pardon, that's the wrong gender, Shakti. Shakti.
Shakti, yes.
The other was Amrita Ma.
Amrita.
And she chose the latter. And she actually legally changed her name.
In the intro segment, I was planning on describing the story of Amrita for that exact reason.
And so I'm very familiar with the aspects of say the nectar of the goddess, the nectar of immortality, and so forth. And she is indeed that. And we have enjoyed a great time.
Great, really great.
The second question I have for you is, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Yeah, the work through which I'm going through right now is that there are many mythologies which are yet untapped in India. For example, because of urbanization, because of migrations from rural to urban, these mythologies are losing ground. So I would like to document those mythologies. That is one thing. Then the second thing is in the words of one of our Indian authors, Devdutt Patnaik, he said that we speak the language of two truths. It is my truth and your truth. So there is nothing like the truth. And mythology actually helps you to coexist with multiple truths.
Mm.
And that sense of coexistence, that sense of the beauty of diversity is somewhere is losing ground, which is there in India, where it is that whatever I say is the truth and you are going to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually would like to work on that field where let people coexist together.
Hmm.
Why should there be a conflict? So, and mythologies tell us you have the Shiva mythology existing with the Vaishnava mythology.
Hmm.
It may be philosophically different, but yet they coexist.
And mm-hmm. that's one of the things we looked at India
for. It's truth for a Shaivite, it is truth for the Vaishnavite. Let them exist. So let people with diverse identities also exist similarly in this world. That is the purpose which I feel I would like, I try to work.
And I fully support you in that. And to that, I would say that you have given us the opportunity to each of us, we both can be right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And not make the other wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Wrong.
Yeah. And finally, who inspires you?
My teachers, Dr. S.A. Dange, who started this school of thought in India, has been my source of inspiration.
Hmm.
And his wife and my mentor, Dr. S.S. Dange, Sindhu Dange, she started this course. So these are my guiding lights. But at the same time, I get fascinated with works of writers like Gunther Sontheimer, or another great professor from your Arizona University, Anne Feldhaus.
Hmm.
So she her writings they inspire me a lot, and actually they help me to reach out to my people and to try and locate that mythologies which are likely to be lost in the years to come.
Hmm.
So these are the sources of my inspiration.
Well, I have to say that I can add you to my list of those who inspire, because you have just shared some things that are just extraordinary. And to that end, I wish to extend to you an invitation. Should you find yourself in the Santa Barbara area, we'd love to have you come in studio and continue this dialogue. This is fantastic.
Yeah, and this was a very great experience of exploring what I was thinking about, and I really liked this idea, and of course we look forward to work in collaboration with the Joseph Campbell Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And we have got a number of students who are enthusiastic and who would be working for the similar cause. So it is like I would say that like-minded people are coming together.
Yes.
in this world.
Absolutely.
And those are the exact chills I feel in talking with you. So thanks so much for meeting with us and extending this conversation across the world exactly 12 hours, literally on the other side.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you
for joining us. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. This has been Mythosophia, exploring the depths of myth and wisdom. And until next time, love to Lal.